And now, live from Tribune Tower, Chicago, this is the WGN Radio Theater with Carl Amari.
Dragnet.
The Jack Benny Program.
I'm that man. Matt Dillon, United States Marshal.
Yes, it's Maxwell House Coffee Time, starring George Burns and Gracie Allen.
Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum.
We offer you Escape.
It's time once again for another comedy episode of Our Miss Brooks.
Suspense.
Countdown for blastoff. X-1.
Richard Diamond, private detective.
The Johnson Wax Program with Fibber McGee and Molly.
Kraft presents The Great Gildersleeve.
Yeah.
About 7 minutes after 11 p.m. here on a Sunday, October 2nd, 2016. This is program 118 in the WGN Radio Theater series. I'm your host, Carl Amari. To my right, the vivacious and very effervescent Lisa Wolf. What's up, Lisa?
What's up, Carl?
How you doing?
Great. Thanks.
We have Mike Gastella in the house. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Our executive producer. And then Elif Garris, our producer, is in the house as well. What's up? We got a lot of people here today. What's up, Elif?
Hey, not too much. What's up with you?
Nothing. Ready to rock and roll. And we have Dave Weiske here. He is the he is with Cat's Pride. He's the vice president of customer success, and he's going to pick another winner of our Cat's Pride kitty litter contest. Someone is going to get a year's supply of Cat's Pride kitty litter. That's coming up in just a few minutes. In this hour, we'll tune into The Life of Riley, starring William Bendix as Riley in the haunted house. Then in hour two, it's Escape with Castling the Ruins. And then the Screen Director's Playhouse presentation of Night Has a Thousand Eyes. So lots of classic radio coming your way here all the way to 2 o'clock in the morning, all brought to you in part by Cat's Pride.
It's time for Celebrity Scoop, brought to you by Cat's Pride. Meow!
This actress stars in the upcoming thriller Kidnap as a mother who will stop at nothing to recover her kidnapped son.
And what do you win?
A $25 gift certificate for Lou Malnati's, home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza.
All right, here's a hint. Well, the number to call, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. She was the hottie in Swordfish.
Someone the NSA once listed as the most dangerous hacker in America. Sure don't look like much.
Yeah, I date her. All right, 312-981-7200. We'll find our winner after this break.
Welcome back. This is show 118 of the WGN Radio Theater. We are playing Celebrity Scoop. Let's play it again.
Someone the NSA once listed as the most dangerous hacker in America. Sure don't look like much.
We have Alan Zetta from Chicago. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. We're glad you got through, and we're hoping that you recognize that actress.
Yes, it is the stunningly vivacious and beautiful Halle Berry.
Yes, Halle Berry, and I agree with you, and Carl apparently
Absolutely.
Agrees with you as well.
Oh, I know. He has a secret crush on her.
Well, and, you know, and some others, too, but you are a winner. You've won a $25 gift certificate for Lou Malnati's, home of Chicago's very best deep dish pizza. My favorite, you can find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnatis.com. Thank you so much for calling. We hope you enjoy the rest of the show tonight.
I do. I enjoy all the shows.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anzetta. All right. We have Dave Weiske here from Cat's Pride. What's up, Dave? How are you, sir?
Doing well, Carl. Doing well, Lisa. How are you guys?
We're good.
I'm good, too.
So, you know, you guys are so generous. You're a sponsor, and you're very generous, and give away a year's supply of Cat's Pride kitty litter every month to our listeners. All they have to do is send in a photograph of their cat. Send it to catspridephoto@gmail.com. And we had a bunch of them this month. And Dave will be picking a winner in just a few minutes. But before we do that, Dave, let's talk a little bit about Cat's Pride and why people should switch from whatever brand they're using to Cat's Pride.
Well, Cat's Pride, it's lightweight. That's what's critical. I think for our journey on this product, it is revolutionary. I mean, we're seeing other lightweight products out there, but they have fillers. They have all kinds of other products in it, but ours is truly natural clay, and it's the lightest thing that's out there. Right now, we're 50% lighter in our Cat's Pride Ultimate Care, and what I'd like to do is I actually served up some work for you guys to go ahead and share a couple of recent reviews. We get reviews all the time, and they're coming in every single day, and they're extremely positive. So, Lisa, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, and I also wanted to add to that that we have gotten a lot of feedback from people, not only who have won every month with us, but people who have tried the product from hearing us talk about it. And we have gotten nothing from positive, other than positive reviews.
Great.
One of the users said this, one of the best litters I have ever used. No scent, which is wonderful because I'm allergic to a lot of scents. We have one cat in our home, so this litter lasts quite a while before having to add more. It clumps very well. Well, stays intact when you scoop the lumps. The clumps contain the odor, too. No dust, no tracking. This is fabulous. Very good product. Highly recommended. David, doesn't get any better than that.
Doesn't get any better.
No, and I think it's very important, too, because I hear when we get emails from people and texts and things, they talk about how you guys have a non-scent version of Cat's Pride. It's not only lighter, half the weight as others, and still the same amount of uses, but you have one of your brands has no scent at all. It's
right.
Just which is great,
right? And it's also hyperallergenic, and that is critical for people that are very sensitive to allergies, including cats and people.
And I just don't like scents. I just prefer to have it unscented. To me, it seems cleaner that way. And there is no product that I know of on the market that has the lightweight product and unscented. And, of course, like you say, revolutionary, made of 100% clay.
Now, this person says, let me start off by saying that I have two cats, which shouldn't be that smelly, but they're two smelly cats. We have a litter box on each floor, three in total, but they fill all of them up very quickly because the litter boxes are on three different floors. I needed something that is unbearable. I need something that is not unbearably heavy because I have to carry it up and down the stairs. And your brand does a great job because it's half the weight. But it also works just as well, if not better, than other brands. So this is great. And also, another very important reason to switch to Cat's Pride is because a portion of every sale is what they've done company-wide with all of the brands of the Cat's Pride Fresh and Light. Every one of these, scented or unscented, hypoallergenic, if you purchase these, a portion of the proceeds go to help cats and dogs in shelters all across the
country.
That's
correct, and specifically the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation. And we've aligned with Catherine Heigl, which has been a great relationship, and we continue to go forward with her. She was actually on Live with Kelly just two weeks ago,
and we've
got a huge media campaign that's coming up this spring. We're going to be on all the big networks, daytime shows, and she's going to be out there interviewing. So right now she's a little bit pregnant. I believe she's 6 months along. So we're really excited for her, and we're excited about the relationship.
And she has a lot of cats because we went to her ranch, and I got to meet all of her cats and dogs and her whole family. And she loves Cat's Pride, and that's why she wanted to endorse it. And it's great with the foundation too. So if you do switch, there's lots of reasons to switch to Cat's Pride, folks. We've just named a few of them. One, it's half the weight as other kitty litters, same amount of uses, and you can get the non-scent, which is great. And also, you're going to help cats and dogs in shelters all across the country.
Right, and also the lightweight product. We have literally taken off 1,000 trucks off the road, basically by going with a lighter product because we can get twice the amount.
And this is 1,000 trucks a year?
Yes, a year.
Wow, okay, that's big.
It's phenomenal. We believe that will double in the next 2 years. With the momentum we've got right now.
Fantastic.
You know, Dave, we believe in you, and we believe in Cat's Pride, which is why we endorse it here on WGN
right.
Radio Theater. So we appreciate
it. We want to thank Dan Jaffe and thank
well.
You and the whole company for supporting this show. Now, let's get down to giving one of our listeners a year's supply of Cat's Pride kitty litter, which is a terrific, terrific prize.
Here's the bag, and I'm going to open this up, and if we can get a drum roll, that would be awesome.
Got it. So we are looking at Laurel Whetstone. Her cat is Kit Kat, and she's from Elmwood Park, Illinois. Congratulations, Laurel.
All right, so Laurel is a big winner. She sent a picture in, and you know it's as easy as that, folks. All you have to do is take a picture of your kitty cat, send it in to us at catspridephoto@gmail.com. Put your name and your cat's name and your city and state.
And we will have another drawing at the end of October, so feel free to submit again each month. Do it again, and you may be a winner at the end of October, so stay with us.
Yeah, Dave and Dan will come in, and it's great to see you, Dave. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And you can get Cats Pride really everywhere, right? I mean, you know, it's available everywhere.
And I think, you know, Chicagoland area, you're talking Jewel, Mariano's, you can go into Kroger. Walmart stores carry it. And if you talk about getting online, you can go to Amazon or Chewy.com as well as Walmart.com. Walmart just recently purchased Jet.com for $3.3 billion. And they're going to enhance their whole online experience. So
very good.
We hope that we're part of that escalation of their success there.
Well, just have Catherine give them a call.
Will do.
And we'll see you next month
to give away
another year supply of Cats Pride Kitty Litter. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, guys.
And thanks to Dan Jaffe as well and the whole company. All right, it's time for our first radio show for this evening. It's a comedy. And it's all about Halloween. We're doing all Halloween shows throughout the entire month of October. This is The Life of Riley. Let's go back to October 29th, 1944, William Bendix starring in The Haunted House, part one of The Life of Riley.
Here he is. In the movie Wake Island, he was the Brooklyn Marine. In Abroad with Two Yanks, he's Biff the Private. But tonight, he's just an overgrown kid anxiously waiting for Halloween.
I'll never forget. When I was just a boy, every Halloween, my father used to stick me in the front window. We were too poor to buy a pumpkin.
The American Meat Institute presents William Bendix in The Life of Riley. And now, on behalf of all those engaged in supplying meat to the nation, the American Meat Institute presents The Life of Riley with William Bendix as Riley. By day, Riley is engaged in the serious business of war production as a riveter in a California aircraft plant. But tonight, we see his less serious side. It's two nights before Halloween, and Riley is full of the spirit of the thing. It's quite dark out, and Riley's son, Junior, is just returning from a meeting of the Young Wildcats, his club, in a very thoughtful mood.
Is that you, Pop?
Shh. Yeah, Junior?
Oh, what are you doing hiding on the back porch?
Listen, peek in the kitchen window and see what your mother's doing.
She's washing the supper dishes. Say, Pop, what are you doing with that false face on? You're Mickey Mouse, huh?
No, I'm not Mickey Mouse. I'm the Rat Man of Blood Bucket Castle.
Oh, at the dime store, they sell those false faces for Mickey Mouse.
Never mind. I bet your mother will think I'm the Rat Man.
Oh, you gonna play a trick on Mom?
Yeah. You see, last night we saw a horror picture about a nice, gruesome character, the Rat Man. He was a vampire, has lunch on people's necks.
Oh, he ain't a rat. He's a bat.
Oh, well, he's very depressing. Anyway, afterwards, your mom was so scared something would pop out of a doorway at her, she walked all the way home in the middle of the street.
Mom said you made her walk out there.
I just invited her out in the street because it ain't polite to leave a lady walking on a sidewalk all alone. You watch now when I scratch at the door, she opens it up and sees me in this thing.
Okay, Pop, go ahead.
Okay, all I hope is she don't faint. Watch now.
Pop,
what?
Bats don't growl, they squeak.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Shh.
Who's there?
We got her guessing.
Well, I never... It's Mickey Mouse.
Junior.
Junior, go get your father some cheese.
Ha ha! You sure fooled her, Pop.
Yeah. Well, they don't make these masks as good as they used to. Or else maybe I got a very strong personality and it leaks through, probably.
Isn't it a little early for Halloween tricks, Riley?
Well, it don't hurt to get a head start. Halloween's my favorite holiday. Look, Junior, there's something else I bought at the Five and Dime. You see this book? Ghost Stories.
Well, thanks, Pop, but I don't want to read any ghost stories tonight.
What's the matter? You don't believe in ghosts, do you?
No, I don't believe in ghosts, but I don't want to read anything that might change my mind. Too many people think there's ghosts now.
Say, Dumpling, what's the matter with him?
Well, I don't know. Ever since he came home from school today, he's been asking me if I believe in haunted houses.
What a question. With the housing shortage, as sure as it is, who's going to leave a house empty for spooks?
Well, there's one empty house up on Chestnut Hill, Riley. You know, the old Sherwin place. Some people say that's haunted.
Yeah?
Mrs. Cornwell claims she saw a pale white face at the window, too.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Oh, but Mrs. Cornwell's a great one for ghosts. She's always holding seances and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. That Cornwell kid's in Junior's club, too. I bet he's got our boy believing in ghosts. Well, I'm going to have a head-to-head talk with Junior. So you see, Junior, if I tell you there's no ghost, you can take my word for it. After all, I've been your father for 13 years, ain't I?
Oh, sure, Pop, but if there aren't any ghosts, what haunts haunted houses?
Listen, Junior, nothing haunts haunted houses.
Oh, yes, they do, Pop. Johnny Cornwell's mother proved the house was haunted.
How did she?
She said she saw a ghost face in the window up at the old Sherwin house. It was a horrible face, too.
Darwin, Mrs. Cornwell must have seen her own reflection. There's a dame should walk into a room backwards and break her face to you slowly.
Oh, then, Pop, then she came home and held a seance. She asked if what she saw was the ghost of Alice Sherwin, and she got three raps on the table. Well, that means yes in ghost language.
Fine language. All they can do is knock. They ought to be newspaper columnists.
You better not make fun of ghosts, Pop.
Look, Junior, would you sooner believe a ghost than your old man?
No, Pop. But if the ghost said it was a ghost, it ought to know.
Okay, I can see you're a septic. Now, we'll have a seance right here to prove what Mrs. Cornwell saw wasn't that Sherwin girl's ghost. Come on, put your hands up on this table. Huh?
Oh, gosh, Papa, are you going to ask a ghost to rap?
I'll show you. I'll put my hands on there, too, see? Okay, now I'll ask something. Are there any ghosts? See? No answer. No ghosts.
Nah, Pop. You have to ask for raps. Two means no. Three raps means yes.
Oh, well, okay. Two raps for no, three for yes. Now, I'll ask him again. Did Mrs. Cornwell see a ghost up at Sherwin's old haunted house?
Gosh, Pop, it said no.
You see, that proves it. Mrs. Cornwell's a phony.
Well, ask him again if there are any ghosts.
Okay. Are there any ghosts? Rap two for no. See that? The ghosts themselves say there aren't any ghosts. That proves it.
Wait a minute, Pop. How could a ghost rap two for no if there aren't any ghosts?
Well, that's very simple. I was just kidding, Sonny. I did that rapping myself. Honest.
Well, your hands were on the table.
Yeah, but my feet weren't. Look it. I just kicked up under that table with my foot like this.
Oh, Pop, I bet you wouldn't kid around like that in a genuine haunted house like the Sherwin place.
Well, sure I would, only I can't because I ain't going there.
Would you be scared to go if you were going?
Me? No.
Oh, that's good, Pop. No, I ain't scared to go neither.
How do you mean?
Well, down at my club tonight, we got to talking what we'd do Halloween. So we made it up we'd go find out if Sherwin's old house was haunted or if it wasn't.
Yeah. I pity any ghosts when them young wildcats get in that house.
Oh, we ain't all going inside, Pop. Just one of us got elected to go inside. The poor guy who got the short straw.
Who got it?
Well, I did.
I see. Well, Junior, you show him you know there aren't any ghosts in there. I'm proud of you, Junior, walking in there all alone. I think that's
Well, I won't be all alone. I made up a rule the fellow who had to go in could take in another fella. his best friend.
But that's okay, too. If the guy you picked is a real friend, he'll go like a shot. Who'd you pick?
I picked you, Pop.
Well, I bet that... me. Look, Junior, I'm probably going to be very busy and...
Pop, besides, you ain't scared to go, are you?
Well, no, but... The...
And you're my best friend, aren't you?
Huh? Well, yeah, I guess I am. Actually, the saying is that your mother is your best friend.
Well, I couldn't ask Mom to go. And I'm sure glad you're coming with me.
Yeah, me too, Junior.
All right, there's the first portion of The Life of Riley with William Bendix's Riley Good Haunted House Halloween Show from 1944. We'll get back to it in a few minutes. Let's take a quick break, then it's more. All right, this is the WGN Radio Theater, 11:38 in the morning on a Sunday night. Yeah, it's not 11:38 in the morning, Lisa.
It's not morning.
11:38 at night.
It's definitely not morning.
Why didn't you correct me?
I had fun just listening to you ramble
a little bit. I get so confused because we're on 3 days.
Is there a reason for your confusion?
I'm just normally confused.
That's what I thought.
Life of Riley, that's what we're playing. Yeah, we had to juggle the order around, folks. On the website, I think we have Escape. Then the Life of Riley. I think we have Screen Directors Playhouse, then
right.
Life
then
of Riley.
Life of Riley.
But we switched it around. We're doing Life of Riley first, then Escape, then Screen Directors Playhouse. Sorry, it was a timing thing. It's a technical issue. So that's the order. Did you know, Lisa, that William Bendix played Riley, of course, on radio? And then when it went to television, he couldn't do it on TV because he had some kind of movie contract or something. You know who played him on television for the first season, played Chester A. Riley on television?
Oh, we've talked about that.
Jackie Gleason.
Oh, yeah.
A thin Jackie Gleason. He was not as heavy as he was when they did The Honeymooners.
Yeah, I can only picture him as Ralph.
Yeah, and really interesting. In 1949, the show went to television, made the transition to television, and Jackie Gleason was Chester A. Riley. And then Bendix came on for
How
six
did he
seasons.
Do for that
Good.
Role.
He was great. I mean, Jackie Gleason was great. All right. Well, let's tune into the conclusion now of this Halloween program. October 29th, 1944. Here's the conclusion to The Life of Riley.
Chapter 13. As Lord Twitcher stood there in the dark hall of the great lonely house, he could feel something evil in the very air. A cold wind brushed his cheek, and an icy hand seemed to touch his spine. Suddenly, he saw the thing. And then he heard a sound, a low, wailing sound. Who's that?
Well, it's only me, dear. Did I startle you?
No. No, I was just reading this book here.
Oh, the ghost stories you bought Junior, huh?
Yeah. Such nonsense.
Oh, my, this is a quiet Halloween, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wonder what all those boys in Junior's club are doing tonight.
I know what they're doing. They're all sitting over across from our house right now on the fence, like a row of buzzards waiting for us to come out.
Oh, are they going to the house with you?
Well, they're going as far as the gate of the place to make sure we go in.
But you're not nervous about going, are you, dear? You don't believe in ghosts?
Well, no. You don't believe in them either, do you, Peg?
No. But there is something queer about that house.
Huh?
I wonder what did become of that poor Alice Sherwin.
Well, if nobody knows, I don't want to find out. What did they say happened to her?
Oh, it's an awfully sad story. She was a bride, you know, beautiful girl. Well, they were on their honeymoon in Manila. He was a captain in the Navy. She and her husband were going to come home and live in that old house. Then, well, he was lost in an air raid. Some say they were both killed together. Others say that she followed him because she didn't want to live without him. Well, anyhow, the house stands there empty, waiting for the bride and bridegroom that never came to live in it.
People ought to leave the place alone. And I'm one of the people.
Well, after you go there tonight, maybe people will stop talking and gossiping about the house. Because you'll prove there's nothing there.
Yeah, maybe. And what was all that talk about seeing lights and faces around the place?
Oh, just talk, I suppose.
Yeah.
But they do say that they saw a woman's figure at the window in the attic.
Pop! Junior, what's the idea of sneaking in like that?
It's time to go, Pop.
Huh? Oh, well, yeah, it's a... Well, okay, Junior. Goodbye, Dumplin'.
Goodbye, boys.
It's sure dark out, isn't it, Pop?
Yeah.
Pop, that Sherwin house we're going to, it can't be really haunted, can it?
No.
But it's funny that people have seen a ghost in there.
Yeah, well, look, Junior, when we get in that house, you do just like I do, and you won't see no ghosts.
Oh, what are you going to do, Pop?
I'm going to keep my eyes shut.
It's just midnight, a very dark midnight. Even the moon is hiding on this Halloween. Riley and his son, Junior, are just approaching the rusty iron gate that guards the old Sherwin house, which is said to be haunted. Listen.
Here's the gate, Pop. Let's go in.
Maybe the gate's locked, so we can't get in. Gee, wouldn't that be too bad?
We've got to get in, Pop. The gang's followed us all the way from town, and they're still watching.
Yeah, they trail us like sharks after a sinking ship.
Let's go in, Pop.
Okay. Hey, what's that?
Well, the gate. The hinges are all rusty.
Maybe we ought to go back to town and get some oil, huh?
Come on in the garden, Pop. Gosh, it's dark.
Yeah. Well, follow me, Junior.
Where are you?
Right behind you. Here. Give me your hand.
I see the house, Pop. The moon's coming out of a cloud.
Yeah. Junior.
Huh?
What's that over there?
Huh? I think that's your shadow, Pop.
If that's my shadow, why is it moving while I'm standing still?
It's coming this way.
And since when does a shadow make footsteps?
Good evening, Riley.
Oh, wait, Pop. It's your friend, Mr. Odell, the undertaker.
I don't. Oh, yeah. Oh, how are you, Digger? I never thought I'd be glad to... Never thought I'd be glad to see an undertaker.
You're looking fine, Riley. Very natural. Tell me, what are you doing here around the old Sherwin house?
Oh, nothing, Digger. We're just having some fun on Halloween.
Ah, Halloween. I adore Halloween. It's so gay.
Digger, Do you hang around this old house much?
Oh, yes, indeed. It's one of my favorite haunts.
Haunts? Listen, you don't think there's anything in there, do you?
Who knows? Sometimes as I stroll through this old garden, I feel unseen eyes follow me.
You do, huh?
Riley, you're not going inside the house?
Well, we... thought we might drop in a minute. I could be talked out of it.
Take my advice, Riley. Remain outside. Enjoy the beautiful flowers. They're my favorite flowers. Lilies.
Digger, when you talk about lilies, please don't stare at my chest.
Strange how some people have no interest in horticulture. In my profession, we have a saying, you may not like flowers at first, but eventually they grow on you. By the way, Riley, how tall are you?
Well, I'm about 5 feet. Why?
I'd like to borrow your overcoat Saturday to wear at the football game.
Oh, sure, sure.
I'll pick it up at 1 o'clock. I want to get to the game before they kick off.
Here's the door to the house, Pop. It's open.
Well, leave it open. Why? One thing, Junior, nobody will never be able to say your old man was a coward. Let's go in. Now let's go out.
Wait, Pop. We've only been in one room. We're supposed to go through the whole house.
As far as I'm concerned, this is a one-room house. Come on.
Wait, Pop.
What for?
I told the kids you didn't believe in ghosts, and I said we'd have another seance, like we did at home.
Junior, a blood relationship can only be stretched so far.
Oh, Pop, you said you'd do it in a haunted house, and if we didn't hear anything, it would prove there wasn't any... You know around here.
I already proved there wasn't any you know around here.
Well, you didn't do it right.
Well,
I found out for a seance, the medium has to be tied in a chair so it can't pull no tricks.
Well, okay, Junior. I'd be glad to let you tie me up. Only there ain't no rope. Too bad.
Well, I brought some rope, Pop.
That was swell of you, Junior. I'll remember this. Go ahead, tie me.
There. Can you move your hands or feet?
No, you tied me so tight Dan Green is sitting in. Now, stand over by the window where I can see you.
Oh, here I am, Pop.
Ah, you'll see, Junior. There won't be any raps this time.
Hope you're right, Pop.
Of course I'm right. How can there be any raps when I'm tied up too tight to rap? And I also got my eye on you.
Go ahead, then. Ask if there's any ghosts here.
Okay, now. If there's any ghosts here, rap two times. If there ain't, don't bother. No raps.
Oh, now say, if there are any ghosts, to rap three times.
Okay, but there won't be any. If there are any ghosts, rap three times. Junior... Did you do that?
I didn't. Didn't you?
Frankly, no. Junior, where are you going?
Out the window. Come on.
Don't come back. Untie me, Junior. I can't get this chair through that window. Junior!
Oh, Pop!
Bosh.
Pop, I can't get the knots loose. I better go get a knife. Well,
Junior, don't! Don't forget to come back. I had to open my big mouth for raps, and I got raps. Fine thing, all alone in a house with a... What's that? Who's that?
What are you doing in my house?
I must be going crazy.
Why did you come here?
I wouldn't stay, lady, only I got tied up.
I will... loosen the knots.
Yeah, but... well, thanks. Who are you?
I am Alice Sherwin.
Now I know I'm crazy. I'm talking to a ghost.
Oh, Pop, I'm coming.
Well, Judy...
Please, Don't tell anyone I'm here. I only want to be left alone. Here in my house.
I got a knife and... Pop, you're untied.
Yeah. And it was the ghost that done it. Wait a minute. Her hands. They weren't no ghost's hands. Junior, you go outside and wait for me.
Oh, what are you going to do, Pop?
I'm going to have another talk with that lady ghost.
Why did you want to see me, Mr. Riley?
Well, when I figured out you wasn't a ghost, I got to thinking how lonesome you must be in this house all alone. So I thought maybe you'd like to take a stroll over to my house and meet my family.
Oh, thank you, but...
Oh, if you'd rather not talk, I'll go away.
No, don't go yet. I mustn't be rude to my first guest in so long.
Oh, thanks. Must be kind of a shock when the first man you see in so long looks like I do.
Tell me about your family, Mr. Riley.
Well, my family's named Riley after me. Very nice people, too. That was my son, Junior, that was with me tonight.
It must be wonderful to have a son.
Oh, it's great. I got a daughter, too. A girl. She's 16 now. The boy's 13, but getting older all the time. And there's Peg, that's my wife. She's older than the kids, but younger than me. Say, in that picture of you over the fireplace, I guess that fellow with you, that's your husband.
Yeah. That's Robert.
He's a good-looking fella. Maybe you'd rather not talk about him, though.
Silence won't bring him back.
My wife told me about what happened. Of course, she didn't know the part about your being here.
I don't want anyone to know. I want to stay here, alone, with his memory. It's the least I can do in loyalty to him.
Oh. You mean you think that's what he'd want you to do?
Of course. Does that surprise you?
Well, yes, ma'am, it does. I didn't know him, but from his picture there, I know he was a swell guy. I wouldn't think he'd want you locked up here, throwing the rest of your life away.
Do you think any man wants the wife he loved to forget him in a year or ever?
Well, no, but there's different ways of remembering.
I don't understand.
You can make his dying count for something by helping to beat the people who started this war and teaching the world that it won't pay to ever start another.
You think that I could help end this war?
Well, sure. Everybody can do something. The only thing a person can't do is do nothing.
Oh, I guess you think I've been very selfish, Mr. Riley.
Oh, no. No, you've been shut up in this empty house. You just didn't know what was going on. The people I can't understand are the ones who do know and still don't care. Those people live in something worse than an empty house. They live in an empty brain.
Well, I'm not one of them, Mr. Riley. You've given me something to think about. And I'm very grateful.
Oh, well, gee, that's fine. Well, I guess I'll be going. I'm sure glad you ain't no ghost. Of course, I ain't actually scared of ghosts because I know there ain't no ghosts. Are there?
Of course not.
You know, Mrs. Sherwin, it is kind of dark out in that garden, isn't it? Would you mind walking me to the gate?
The Rileys will be back in a moment. Well, I think we can all agree with Riley that none of us here at home can sit this war out. The war isn't over in Europe, the war isn't over in the South Pacific, and the war isn't over in America's kitchens. You women who have signed up for the duration to keep health-giving meals on America's tables just can't pick out the meat you want and be sure of getting it every time these days. The needs of war are bound to make the varieties and quantities your meat man has vary from day to day. So let's all make good meals out of whatever meats are on hand. And remember this, all meats, regardless of cut or kind, have the same complete, highest quality, good-eating proteins that make meat a yardstick of protein foods. This statement and all statements regarding the nutritional value of meat made on this program are accepted by the Council on Foods and Nutrition of the American Medical Association.
Hiya, Dumplin'. Hey, I got some big news about Halloween.
Yes?
Well, you know, I think I'm going to open up a one-man recruiting outfit. I'm going to recruit Waves, Wax, Spars, and Spooks.
Tune in The Knife of Riley, starring William Bendix, next week at this time. This is Ken Niles saying, see you next week. This is the Blue Network.
7:30 KECA, Los Angeles.
Ah, that network is very blue, Lisa. We need to cheer that network up. That's The Life of Riley, October 29th, 1944, with The Haunted House. That's William Bendix as Chester A. Riley. His wife was Paula Winslow as Peg on there. John Brown was Digger O'Dell, the friendly undertaker. Hope you enjoyed that. Let's take a quick break, then it's more here on the WGN Radio Theater. Thank you, Roger. Thank you, Esmeralda. It is 11 minutes after midnight. Happy Monday morning. And on this hour of the WGN Radio Theater, a very scary episode of Escape from 1947. In our next hour, Edward G. Robinson stars in Night Has a Thousand Eyes, Good Mystery on the Screen, Director's Playhouse. All of this is brought to you in part by Cat's Pride.
It's time for Celebrity Scoop. Brought to you by Cat's Pride. Meow.
This actor stars in the upcoming comedy Office Christmas Party about an epic holiday party meant to impress a client but gets way out of hand.
Mm.
And the winner will get a pair of tickets to see Don't Dress for Dinner October 6th at the Mackinac Art Center.
In Glen Ellen?
In Glen Ellen.
See, I even remembered that.
How do you like
yesterday.
That?
From 2 days ago.
No, that was from 2 days ago on Saturday night.
If you want to win these tickets, folks, and they'll be at Will Call because it's coming up this week,
exactly.
the show. 312-981-7200. That's the number. Here's a hint. This actor was the star of the movie The Gift.
Wow, buddy. I did not recognize you. Gordon Mosley. Oh, my gosh, honey. Yeah. Gordo and I went to school together like,
really?
80 years ago.
Oh, God.
All right, if you know who that actor is, call us 312-981-7200. We'll find our winner after this break.
We are back. This is the WGN Radio Theater. We are playing Celebrity Scoop. Let's play that movie clip again.
Wow, buddy, I did not recognize you. Gordon Mosley. Oh, my gosh, honey.
Yeah.
Gordo and I went to school together like,
really?
80 years ago.
Oh, God.
And we have Joan on the line from LaGrange Park. Hey, Joan.
Hey, how are you?
We're great. How are you?
Well, just getting over a cold.
All right. Well, you sound pretty good. Maybe it's on its way out.
Yeah. I saw that movie on TV not long ago.
Oh, The Gift? Yes. Good Mystery.
Who is that actor, by the way?
Jason Bateman.
Jason Bateman is right. And we'd like to give you a gift, Joan. A different kind of gift. We'll give you a pair of tickets to see Don't Dress for Dinner on Thursday, October 6th. It's playing right now at the Mackinac Art Center through October 9th. And you can get more information at themac.org. So congratulations and thank you for listening and for calling in.
Well, thank you.
And take care. We hope you feel better.
Yes, feel better, Joan. Thanks for listening. All right. It is time for our second classic radio show for this edition of the WGN Radio Theater. It's a good, good mystery called Casting the Ruins. And this is a story on Escape. Escape came to radio in 1947. It was on for seven seasons. And William Conrad and Paul Frees were the voices of escape. They were the narrators of escape. It was radio's greatest series of high adventure and mystery, and it was sort of a cousin to Suspense, quite a bit like Suspense. It was on the same network, too, CBS. But it didn't have the star power of Suspense. Suspense had the movie stars appearing on there. On Escape, it was more supporting actors, really no name stars. Very rarely did they have a name star. Once in a while, Vincent Price. And I think you're going to like this. It's good, good mystery. From November 19th, 1947, Casting the Ruins. Here's part one now of Escape.
Had a hard day at the office. Backache from bending over a hot stove all day. Want to get away from it all?
We offer you Escape.
It is midnight, and you are alone. Suddenly, the room is plunged into darkness. You sit frozen with terror because something is there behind you. Something you feared would come. Something from which you must escape.
Escape, produced and directed by William N. Robeson, and carefully plotted to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
Tonight, we escape to London, and a world made strange and terrifying by the workings of an ancient barbaric curse, as Montague R. James tells it in his weird story, Casting the Ruins.
My name is Edward Dunning. I'm a scientist. I'm used to dealing with facts, not fairy tales. I'm regarded as Britain's leading authority on medieval life. And as such, I've studied much of the ancient fears and barbaric superstitions of those times. I should have been the first to scoff at any suggestion that the ancient powers of evil, the black magic of Teutonic days, could be believed and practiced in the 20th century. A few weeks ago, I should have laughed had you told me that a curse, a hex, could kill a man. Today, I cannot laugh. It has happened to a man I know of. And now, it's happening to me. My first presentiment of danger came on that day a few weeks ago when I dropped in to see Alfred Smythe, secretary of the National Science Association, and found him in a state of irritation.
Blast it all, Dunning. I almost wish you hadn't been so brutally honest in your report on that Carswell paper.
Why? What's the trouble?
Oh, he's such a frightful fellow. He's raising a terrible row.
You mean Carswell himself?
Yes, it's bad enough a vicious charlatan like that calling himself a scientist. But now he's taking all his vindictiveness out on me.
Sorry, old chap. It's really me he'd like to get at.
As a matter of fact, that's just what his last letter was about. He wants to know what supposed authority wrote the report rejecting his paper.
You didn't give him my name.
Heavens, no. As a matter of fact, Dunning, I haven't and I won't, and for a very special reason. Call it silly, call it crazy, call it what you will. I have an uncanny feeling about that man Carswell.
Hmm? Why?
Do you know anything about him?
Nothing. I've never seen him. I only know that he wrote a paper called The Truth of Alchemy. It was hopeless.
Precisely. And why was it hopeless?
Well, besides being abominably written, it was supposed to prove that alchemy, black magic, and such rot actually exists. I think the man really believes it.
Undoubtedly he does, and that's what I mean. He lives in an isolated old house in Warwickshire. He's rarely seen elsewhere, and in his whole career, he's written only two things. This paper and A History of Witchcraft, published 10 years ago.
Yes, of course, I remember now. So that's the man.
Yes, and that book was even worse than this paper. The man has a warped mind. I'm sure he's tried every unhealthy experiment in alchemy, witchcraft, and black magic. There's no telling to what lengths of vindictiveness a man like that might go.
Well, it does sound a bit queer, but...
Not queer, Dunning. Evil.
Oh, come. Man has a right to believe what he likes. He has a right to be angry with me.
Here I've glibly scoffed at the man's life's work.
Well, perhaps I'm being overly suspicious and imaginative, but I think there's more than anger involved here, Edward.
Hmm?
This may sound fantastic to you, but, well, John Harrington wrote the report condemning that witchcraft book of Carswell's 10 years ago. 3 months later, Harrington was dead.
Hmm. But, Alfred, what's the connection?
Harrington died under very peculiar circumstances. He was walking home alone late one night, and suddenly he screamed, broke into a run, lost his hat and stick, and climbed up a tree. A dead branch gave way. He fell and broke his neck. No one's ever been able to explain why it happened.
Come now, Alfred, surely you're not suggesting...
Oh, I don't know what I'm suggesting. I only know that after he reviewed Carswell's book, John Harrington didn't have a moment's peace. Now you've written an unfavorable review of this paper. If I were you, I should keep that fact well hidden.
Oh, Alfred, well, that's ridiculous. Yes. I laughed at Alfred Smythe's fears. How could I have known then that I was to feel the same terror, the same agonized fear which gripped the heart of John Harrington as he crouched, panting, on the branch of a tree for another moment or two of life, while beneath him the thing came closer and closer. I'd almost forgotten the incident when, a few nights later, I was riding home on a late train. I was half drowsing in my seat, barely keeping awake by looking idly at the car card advertisements. The man directly opposite me must have been doing the same, because suddenly I heard him say,
"Here now, what can that one be advertising?"
I followed his eyes to the window beside my head. What I saw brought me bolt upright in my seat.
"In memory of John Harrington, died September 18th, 1937, by falling from a tree. 3 months were allowed."
Mommy, what do you say that means, sir?
Well, I don't know. But I did know. Smythe had been right. The affair with Carswell was not over, but only begun. I asked the conductor about the card, but he was as puzzled as I was. He had never seen it before. The card must have been put there expressly for me. That meant that Carswell knew it was I who had reviewed his paper. How had he found out? I got the answer the next day. I was in the select manuscript department of the British Museum doing some research in the quiet, almost deserted room. I'd been working steadily for an hour, oblivious to my surroundings, when suddenly, just at my shoulder, I heard a voice.
"Dunning, you are allowed 3 months."
I swung around in my seat. There was no one within 20 feet of me. I sat for a moment, shaken, and then I stooped to pick up the papers I had brushed to the floor. I straightened up to find a stout, elderly gentleman standing in front of me.
"Excuse me, sir."
Yes?
"May I give you this paper? I think it should be yours."
"Oh, yes, so it is. I thought I had them all."
"This one seemed to have slid across the floor."
"Thank you very much."
"Not at all, sir. Good afternoon."
He walked slowly away and out of the door. A kindly, stout old gentleman. But there was something about him that made me feel strange. I went over to the attendant.
Yes, Mr. Dunning?
Did you notice that gentleman I was just speaking to?
Oh, yes, of course.
Can you tell me his name?
Why, that's Mr. Carswell. As a matter of fact, he was asking about you only the other day.
Asking about me?
Well, he asked who were the great authorities on medieval science. Of course, I told him you were the only one in the country.
Oh, I see.
Would you like to meet him, Mr. Dunning? I'll see if I can...
No. No, thank you. It was as simple as that. Now Carswell knew. What would be his next move? What was I to expect? I reached home at dusk, and trouble stood on my doorstep in the long face and stooped form of my family doctor.
"I've had to upset your household arrangements, I'm sorry to say, Dunning. I've had to send both your servants to hospital."
"But what happened?"
Something like ptomaine poisoning, I should think. It's nothing serious."
"Well, what could have caused it?"
"Well,
That's the rather odd thing. They tell me they bought some shellfish from a hawker and had it for lunch. I've made inquiries, but I can't find that a hawker called at any other house on this street.
Was this the next move? If so, it had succeeded. I was alone in the house, and my nervousness increased as darkness closed in and the hours advanced toward midnight. I went to bed, but almost immediately I thought I heard something. My study door opening downstairs. I went out and leaned over the banister. There was nothing moving, nothing visible. There was only a sudden, surprising gust of warm air playing about my legs. I went back into my room and locked the door. Suddenly, the lights went out. No doubt it was only a blown fuse, but the chills were playing up and down my spine. I went over to the bed and reached for my watch under the pillow. I suppose I wanted to find out the time. I don't know why. But fumbling on the pillow, my hand touched something far different from a watch. It was like a mouth with sharp teeth and hair around it, not human at all. I fled from my bedroom and spent a long and miserable night locked in the spare room, my ear to the door. But nothing came. I was not disturbed again. In the morning, I searched the house and found nothing unusual. But the mark of fear must have been stamped on my face, for Smythe noticed it next day.
Dunning, you look as if you hadn't slept for weeks. Is anything wrong?
I don't know, Alfred. Yes, there is. Carswell knows.
How?
They told him at the museum.
Of course, we should have thought of that. Has anything happened yet?
I don't know. It's too fantastic. It's probably my mind, hypnotic suggestion or something, but like that man Harrington, I have 3 months left.
Edward.
Must have been hearing things. I'm all on edge. I don't know what to think.
John Harrington had a brother, Henry. Perhaps I'd better get you in touch with him. He might know more about this man, Carswell.
Yes, yes, do it. And quickly. 3 months is not a lot of time. It was arranged. That night, I found myself walking down the dark street that led from the railway station to the Harrington home. It must have been along this same street that John Harrington had walked that last night, where he had broke and run. It must have been one of these trees bordering the lonely road in which he had spent his last horrible moments. The way was dark, and there was no living soul in sight. And suddenly, complete terror gripped me. Somehow I knew that I was being followed. At first I only felt it, and then I heard it. I walked steadily on for a moment, my stomach like ice. It was getting louder, coming closer. Unconsciously, my step quickened. I could barely control myself. I wanted to scream and run. The thing came closer, closer. I confess, I broke and ran madly for my life. I was at a little side street. I turned down it, doubling back toward the railway station. I thought I would never make it. But finally, bright lights loomed before my eyes, and I think that I never have been so grateful for human companionship.
There's no need to run, sir. The 8:40 won't be along for another 5 minutes.
All right, that's the first portion of Casting the Ruins on Escape from November 19th, 1947. More coming your way after these words. Happy Monday morning to you, Lisa, and to you, Elif, and to you, Esmeralda, and to you, Roger. So, and to all of our listeners here on the WGN Radio, thanks for listening. And our listeners stay up late with us. It's very nice. We appreciate it. Now, the listenership is growing, so thank you. Tell a friend that we are here every Saturday and Sunday night, every Saturday and Sunday from 11 p.m. till 2 o'clock in the morning, playing your favorite classic radio shows. And all through October, it's Halloween programming, and we're tuning in to a very sinister tale of escape called Casting the Ruins from November 19th, 1947. John McIntyre is the star. Here's the conclusion to Escape.
I felt very foolish. I couldn't bring myself to walk back down that street to Harrington's. I could only take the train home furtively and call Harrington next morning to beg his forgiveness. He seemed very understanding and asked no questions. Undoubtedly, Smythe had told him something about me. At any rate, he agreed to visit me at a place 2 nights later. And when he arrived and was made welcome, he began to talk about his brother.
Yes, Mr. Dunning. John was in a very bad state for weeks before the accident. If that's what it was. The principal thing seemed to be the notion that he was being followed. It became an obsession.
Yes, I know. I don't think his death was an accident.
Then perhaps you can explain it?
No. But I have one clue. Your brother reviewed a book very severely not long before he died. Just lately, I happened to cross the path of the man who wrote that book.
And his name, of course, is Carswell.
That's right.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, that does it. Before he died, John was beginning to feel, much against his will, that Carswell was at the bottom of his trouble.
Why?
Well, it doesn't make sense.
None of this does. But tell me.
My brother liked music. He went to all the concerts in town, and he made a hobby of collecting the programs. One night, about 3 months before his death, he brought one home and showed it to me. I nearly missed this one, he said. It seems he'd lost his and was hunting for it under his seat when a neighbor, a rather stout elderly gentleman, offered to give John his.
The kind gentleman was Mr. Carswell.
Undoubtedly. I started to leaf through the program and noticed on the second page some rather curious letters carefully written there in black and red ink. Neither of us could make much of it, except that the letters seemed to be runic.
Runes. Runes, of course.
Well, John thought it might be important and debated whether he shouldn't try to return the program to the stout gentleman. But just then the door blew open and a gust of air, of strangely warm air, blew into the room. In a flash, it took the program and blew it straight into the fire.
Yes, your brother was right. He should have returned it.
Well, there's nothing to be done then.
No, perhaps not. But do you know what runic letters mean?
Well, they're old pre-Druid script, I believe. The kind of writing the barbaric tribes used long before the Romans invaded Britain.
Yes, that's right. Casting the runes, they used to call it in the old days. Casting the runes.
What do you mean?
Well, it was a curse, a hex. In primitive England, people thought by casting the runes, that is, handing a person a piece of paper with certain runic letters on it, that you could put that person out of the way, destroy him. It's an old superstition. And the only way to lift the curse was to return the paper to the one who gave it to you. To give it back without his knowing it.
I don't believe that kind of nonsense.
Neither do I.
Then what was it that killed John?
I don't know. Perhaps his fear of the runes, perhaps brooding about it, becoming neurotic, thinking he saw things and heard things and touched things that weren't there. Perhaps his own mind drove him to death.
And what's the difference once you're dead?
No difference at all.
Casting the runes. Oh, it's rubbish.
Yes, of course, but... Good heavens.
What is it?
I just remembered that day at the British Museum. He cast the runes on me. I went swiftly to the writing table, Harrington close behind me. My portfolio was there, full of the scribbled notes I'd been working on that day in the museum. And as I took it in my shaking hands and began leaping desperately through them, one strip of thin, light paper slipped and fluttered toward the open window with uncanny quickness. But Harrington was even quicker and slammed the window shut just in time.
Got it?
Oh, thank heavens. If it were lost or destroyed, like your brother's...
Then you wouldn't be able to return it to Mr. Carswell. Yes. Look at it. It's identical with the one John got.
I looked at the flimsy paper. The characters, carefully traced in red and black, were runes, all right. That ancient language used by the Aborigines of prehistoric Britain. I couldn't decipher them. But as Harrington and I stood looking into each other's eyes, each of us could read the other's thoughts. Science or not, 20th century or not, this sheet of foolscap spells death for its possessor.
It spells death for you.
It must be returned.
Yes, I know.
Go back in such a way that he doesn't know he's received it. That means we can't simply mail it.
No, we can't.
We must do it personally. That'll take doing.
Well, he knows you by sight, doesn't he?
Yes.
You must shave your beard. It'll alter your appearance. He might strike any time.
I have 3 months, as what the warning said.
We've got to make good on this, Dunning. I've searched 10 years for my brother's murderer, and now he must not escape.
I dare not go near Carswell, so Harrington volunteered to keep a watch on him, to let me know when our chance came to return the rooms, if it was ever to come. It was only a night or two after Harrington was there that I arrived home and found a calendar had come in the mail. When I examined it, I found everything after November 19th had been torn out. The next night, I had another envelope of the mail. This time it was a woodcut, an illustration torn out of a book, showing a dark, moonlit road and a man walking on it. And right behind him came a huge, dark shape, some awful demon creature. Under it were written some lines from the Ancient Mariner. And as I sat alone and read them aloud, I felt that now familiar gust of warm air playing about my legs. The man walks on and turns no more his head, because he knows a frightful fiend doth close behind him tread. Now I knew the face of my terror, and it was with me always. Walking down the dark street at night, I heard its footsteps behind me. In my lonely house at midnight, it roamed the halls. Like the Ancient Mariner and John Harrington, I never turned to look. I couldn't. My nerves were going, and I could do nothing but wait. The days, the weeks slipped by, and still Harrington had no plan. I checked off the days on the calendar Carswell had sent. Now there were 8 days remaining, then 6, then 3, 2, 1. It was the evening of the 18th. My last day on Earth was to begin at midnight. I was sitting alone in my living room, bathed in perspiration, fighting to keep my nerves in check. Suddenly, I felt that warm gust of air. I listened. There were soft footsteps. A shadow seemed to cross the hall door. And then the footsteps blended into a loud banging.
No, no, not yet. I still got one day more. Not yet.
Dunning, it's me.
Oh, thank heaven. Harry.
What's the matter, man? What is it?
It was you. You were knocking on the door. Your footsteps.
Yes, of course.
Oh, thank heaven.
I thought I... Look, man, you've got to pull yourself together. It's tonight we have our chance.
What chance?
Carswell leaves Victoria Station by bullet train tonight at 10. I'll get on with him there. You take the car I brought and drive to Croydon. Get on the train there. And be sure to bring the paper.
Yes. Yes, I have it.
You've shaved already. Good. Everything depends on his not recognizing you.
Yes, Harrington. Yes. Suppose he changes his mind. Suppose he doesn't take that trip. My time runs out tomorrow.
He'll be there. And you'll do it. You'll do it well. You've got to.
I stood on the platform at Croydon, my mind in a daze. I thought the train would never come, but it did. I saw Harrington at the window. He stared coolly at me. Of course, there was to be no sign of recognition. I entered the coach and slowly made my way down the aisle to the compartment where Harrington sat. Opposite him, staring full into my face, was Carswell. He looked up as I sat down. His eyes were heavy-lidded, his face bland. It was impossible to tell whether he knew. The train started. The next stop was Dover, at the end of the line. My last chance. It was time to cast the rules. It was a strange ride. Carswell and I seated face to face, staring into each other's eyes. Harrington off to the side, pulling at his face with twitching fingers. If I could have only had a few whispered moments with him to plan our strategy, but that was impossible. The moments dragged tortuously, and no one moved.
Then suddenly Carswell leaned forward.
I beg your pardon, sir. Haven't we met?
Met? Well, I don't think so, sir. Not unless you're in the plumbing business.
Plumbing? No. Hardly.
I hadn't planned it that way. The words, the accent, just seemed to come by themselves. And Carswell sat back, an enigmatic expression on his face. I wished desperately to know what he was thinking. Then suddenly he got up and went out into the corridor. Was this my chance? I was about to slip over to his bags to see if there were a way to secrete the rooms within them, when I caught Harrington's eye and read a warning in them. Carswell from the corridor was watching, waiting to see if we recognized each other. I muttered a prayer of thanks I hadn't moved. Carswell came back and took his seat. As he did so, wild, exultant hope surged up in my throat, for something slipped off his seat and dropped noiselessly to the floor. It was his ticket case, and he didn't see it. It was a small cardboard ticket case with a pocket on the cover. If I could just get to it and slip that tiny piece of paper into that pocket. For 15 agonizing minutes, I sat there and stared at it. If only Carswell would go out. But he sat stolidly staring straight ahead. We were coming into the outskirts of Dover, the train slowing down. Suddenly, Harrington stood up, reached up to the rack above Carswell to get his coat and bag. I stared at him blankly for a moment, surprised by his sudden clumsiness. And then I realized what he was up to. The bag, the coat, a briefcase all came tumbling down upon Carswell.
What the devil?
Oh, I say, I'm sorry. I'm terribly sorry.
You clumsy fool, you might have injured me. What were you trying to do?
Well, it was my only chance. Carswell stood facing Harrington. I reached down, got the ticket case, and with trembling fingers slid the paper into the pocket. He turned sharply to me, and I extended the case toward him.
Excuse me, sir. Is this yours?
Yes, it's my ticket case. Where'd you find it?
Here on the floor. Must have dropped off when...
Yes, I'm much obliged to you, sir.
Not at all. Not at all.
He looked at me fiercely, his rage at Harrington still twisting his face into a devil's mask. Then he glanced briefly into the ticket case and put it into his pocket. On the railway pier at Dover, Harrington and I followed a few steps behind Carswell. I felt like I might faint. Carswell went straight to the gangway of the boat, and there the purser
Excuse
stopped
me,
him.
Sir, does your friend have a ticket?
My friend? What the devil do you mean? I'm traveling alone.
Well, that's funny. I could have sworn there was another gentleman right there beside you, walking just at your elbow.
Well, there isn't. And I suggest you see an oculist.
Oh, I didn't see. I just felt. Sorry, sir. Must have been your rugs. My mistake.
Come on, Dunning. Our job's done.
I didn't sleep that night. I lay awake and listened. But there were no footsteps, no warm gusts of air, nothing to disturb me. All day I felt remarkably free, although this was to have been my last day on Earth. But only just now, when Harrington came in, could I really relax.
Well, Dunning, have you seen the afternoon paper yet?
I know, not yet.
Well, here, look at it, on the second page. There.
Abbeville, France. An English traveler examining the front of St. Wolfram's Cathedral today was struck on the head and killed instantly by a stone falling from the scaffolding. A note of mystery was added by the fact that although the cathedral was undergoing repairs, no workman was on the scaffolding at the time of the accident. The traveler was identified by papers found on him as a Mr. Carswell of Warwickshire.
Of course, it could have been an accident.
Yes. Yes, it could have been.
Escape is produced and directed by William N. Robeson, and tonight brought you Casting the Runes by Montague R. James, adapted for radio by Irving Ravitch and John Dunkel, with John McIntyre as Edward Dunning, Jan Wolfe as Harrington, and Bill Conrad as Carswell.
The special musical score was conceived and conducted by Cy Feuer. Next week, we escape with H.G. Wells' gripping story, The Country of the Blind. Good night, then, until this same time next week when we again offer you Escape. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
That is Escape from November 19th, 1947, Casting the Ruins, with John McIntyre, also William Conrad, and the cast is heard on CBS. Let's take a break, then it's more here on the WGN Radio Theater. All right, thank you, Esmeralda. Thank you, Roger. It is 1:06 in the morning. This is the WGN Radio Theater. What is this music? I've heard this before. It's kind of elevator-y.
I'm jamming out.
It's from a movie.
Give me a moment.
Can't you picture it?
Ella's having a good time in there. Look at that.
She's keeping herself busy.
I think she has ants in her pants.
I do.
My mom used to say that to me growing up. What, do you have ants in your pants? My dad said that too a lot. Can't you just sit still? Do you have ants in your pants?
Every kid has ants in their pants.
Is that something that's kind of antiquated? Like, do parents still say that to their kids?
So.
Yeah, ants in their pants?
No.
Did your mom say that to you?
No.
I don't remember.
Well, I'm saying it to you.
It's Stan Getz and Charlie Bird. Desafinado.
Oh.
Yeah, gosh. I'm real familiar with that.
Yeah, right.
So in this hour of the WGN Radio Theater, good radio adaptation of a kind of scary movie, Night Has a Thousand Eyes, Edward G. Robinson from 1949. It's all brought to you in part by Cat's Pride.
It's time for Celebrity Scoop. Brought to you by Cat's Pride. Meow.
This actor is the voice of Darth Vader in the upcoming space film Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, the ninth theatrical film in the series.
All right.
And the winner will win a pair of tickets to see Don't Dress for Dinner at the Mackinac Art Center.
Right. So in other words, Don't Dress for Dinner means come to dinner in the buff.
Naked.
Yeah. All right. 312-981-7200. Tickets will be at will call for you if you win. Call now, 312-981-7200. Here's a hint. This actor can be heard here in the movie The Field of Dreams.
This field, this game, it's a part of our past, Ray.
You know what I mean, Ray?
I do. What a voice that guy's got.
Yep, 312-981-7200. We'll find our winner after this break.
We are back. This is the WGN Radio Theater, and we are playing Celebrity Scoop. Let's play it again.
This field, this game, it's a part of our past, Ray.
And we have Mark on the line from Milwaukee. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how are you? I love your program.
Oh, thank you. Well, we love that you're listening to our program.
Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome. One of you is very good looking and the other is very funny.
We'll leave it at that. Mark, what is that voice? What actor's voice
James
is that?
James Earl Jones.
James
yes.
Earl Jones is absolutely right. We are so thrilled to give you a pair of tickets for Don't Dress for Dinner, or as Carl calls it, come to the dinner table in the buff.
Yes.
That's how he likes to put it. This is October 6th at the Mackinac Art Center. It's running right now. You can get information at themac.org. Thank you so much for listening, and I'm going to take the good-looking half, and I'll give him the funny half.
All right. Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks. You're funny, Lisa.
You're funny, funny looking.
Funny smelling.
You're funny looking.
Yeah. All right, so we have a Screen Director's Playhouse presentation of A Good Mystery. Now, this was another one of those, there were several of these, where they would take a movie, condense it, put it on the radio, kind of have to take the script and adapt it for radio because it was, the original script was for a visual medium. And the difference, though, with the Screen Director's Playhouse was the added element of director participation. The actual director of the film would be on hand to sort of have a curtain call and talk about the making of the movie. It was kind of nice. It was sponsored by RCA Victor, and it came to radio in 1949, transitioned to television. I have no idea how they did these on television. I mean, think about that.
Yeah.
You had a movie,
right?
And then they had to do an abbreviated version on television of the movie. It's very hard to get my head around that, to figure that out. But they did, and it was on the air for a long time. So we have a Screen Director's Playhouse presentation of Night Has a Thousand Eyes, starring Edward G. Robinson, from February 27th, 1949, part one now, of the Screen Directors Playhouse.
From Hollywood, the NBC Theater presents...
Screen Directors Guild Assignment, production Night Has a Thousand Eyes, director John Farrell, star Edward G. Robinson.
Presents the Screen Directors Guild production of A Chronicle of Fear. Paramount's Night Has a Thousand Eyes, with its original team of screen director John Farrell, screen star Edward G. Robinson, and William Demmer. Tonight's story, Night Has a Thousand Eyes. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Farrell.
Night Has a Thousand Eyes is a story of the supernatural, but it is not a flight of fancy. Counterparts of the strange phenomena in tonight's story have been the subject of recent scientific study by some of our universities. Thus, through the medium of film, and now through the radio, we attempt to reveal a bizarre and a rather terrifying aspect of the strange, strange world in which we live. Now, for the first time on the air, here is Night Has a Thousand Eyes, starring Edward G. Robinson as John Triton, with William Demarest as Lieutenant Sean.
In the drawing room of a fine suburban home, a young man named Carson reads a strange manuscript while the company listens gravely and silently.
My dear Carson, as you read this manuscript, I will be dead. No one is to blame. My death was as certain as all the other strange events I foresaw. Some of you who have seen me die will doubt this story and dismiss it as a series of contrived events and coincidences. But you, Carson, and some of the others will know that there are things on Earth still hidden from us, still secret and unfathomed. I suppose most men can look back and see the exact point where destiny touched them. My destiny came upon me on the night of August 3rd, 1929. I was billed as Triton, the mental wizard. Like most mind-reading acts, it was a phony, but a first-class phony. Jenny, my lovely fiancée, had collected all the questions from the audience, and my good friend Whitney Cortland was ready for his part at the piano. Now, ladies and gentlemen, from where I stand, I shall endeavor to read the questions which you have written and which are now unopened, mind you, in that glass bowl. Now, if I may have a little quiet music, Mr. Cortland. Let me see. I sense a name. Lady's name. Clara Byers. Miss Byers asks a question. She wishes to know. Something's wrong. There are disruptive impulses coming from the audience. A woman in a white dress, a little boy. Madam, you there in the third row. Your little boy is in great danger. You must go home at once. At once! Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll continue where we left off. If I may have some quiet music, Mr. Cortland. The incident disturbed me. But then I forgot about it entirely until late that night when the telephone rang in my room. It was the woman calling to tell me that she had come home to find the boy's room in flames. She had arrived just in time to save the child's life. And I was worried, deeply worried, although not yet frightened. There were other incidents, one of them brought on by Courtney's usual concern about our economic situation.
Well, kids, it's the same old story. Broke again. We could stand a little ready cash. Matter of fact, I'm going to put our last 10 spot on ready cash in the fifth at Green Meadows.
Ready cash?
No, not Reddy Cash. He'll fall and have to be destroyed. Peer Gynt. Peer Gynt by two lengths. Reddy Cash fell and had to be destroyed. Peer Gynt won by two lengths. It occurred to me that we might make fortunes this way. I didn't want to. It scared me. I began having a crazy feeling that by telling them, I was making the things come true. I began to wonder, would anything have happened if I'd kept quiet? And then one dismal, rainy day, I had my chance to find out. I was coming out of the theater. A little boy recognized me and asked me for an autograph. And then he turned to skip away. Wait, son! I'd had a vision of a car skidding on the slick pavement. A wild cry. And then I thought, no, perhaps if I keep it to myself, it won't happen. Nothing, son. Just run along now. Run along. He went. A moment later... It was no use. After the boy's death, I knew I could foresee these events, but I was powerless to prevent their coming true.
Look, Johnny, I just met a big oil man down in the lobby who wants us to come in on this Comanche Hills oil field.
Well, so what?
Well, do you suppose you could get a hunch on a sporting proposition like that? Might make us a lot of money.
No, it's no good, Court. We're washed up on hunches.
Why, Johnny?
Well, because I'm scared, Jenny, plain scared.
I haven't had a very good feeling about it myself, Johnny.
Well, all right. We'd better get down to the theater then and earn it the hard way. Curtain in 20 minutes.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, if you will all please concentrate on the sealed questions you have addressed to me, please. A little quiet music, Mr. Cortland. I'm concentrating on a particular envelope. A young lady's handwriting. She, the young lady. The lady, I looked at Jenny. Stared at Jenny, so beautiful, so fragile and desirable and so much to me. I saw her and something else.
Johnny.
Bring down the curtain.
Johnny, what's the matter?
Bring down the curtain, I tell you. Bring down the curtain!
Are you sure you feel better now, Johnny?
Oh, sure, Jenny. I just felt a little dizzy out there.
You sure had us worried there for a while.
Oh, Court.
Yeah?
Had a... sort of a minor hunch about that Comanche Hills oil proposition. Be one of the richest oil pools in the country. Make us all rich.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you, Johnny. Now let's go out and eat.
You and Jenny go ahead. I'll join you later. Maybe it was the wrong decision. But I went away. What I'd seen that night on the stage had been Jenny's death. If I stayed, we'd be married and there'd be a child. The child would live, but Jenny wouldn't. I had to go away to save Jenny's life and save my own sanity. I knew Cortland would take care of Jenny and Comanche Hills Oil would take care of both of them. Yes, but I knew I had to get away from people, especially the people I loved. I went away. It didn't work. A year later, I heard that Jenny had married Cortland. She died, and her daughter Jean was born. I read about it in Variety. For 20 years, I lived almost a hermit's life and had no more visions. This gift or the curse seemed to wither it from this use. And then after 20 years, on the night of Jean's debut, I stood outside in the crowd and I watched her go inside the fine hotel, holding tight to Court's arm. Jenny's daughter was lovely, and I was proud. I watched them disappear inside, and after 20 years of peace, it happened. For a moment, I saw the image of wreckage, the smoking wreckage of an airplane. And then it was gone. What did it mean this time? But nothing happened. And I forgot about it completely for 3 months. Until one day in my shop, I turned on a small radio I just repaired.
News brought by your Comanche oil reporter. New York. Flying his converted army bomber, Whitney Cortland, multimillionaire president of Comanche Oil, took off from LaGuardia Airport early today in an attempt to smash the east-west transcontinental record. He and his pilot, former army flyer Richard Sims.
No! It was Warren Jean. Miss Cortland, I'm sorry to force my way in here, but I have an extremely important message for your father.
I'm sorry, but my father isn't here now.
See here, old man, I'm Miss Cortland's fiancé. Miss Cortland...
No, you've got to reach your father when he lands in Wichita to refuel.
But why?
You must halt the flight.
Halt the flight?
That's absurd.
Why should father give up his
flight?
But
if he doesn't, this plane will crash.
How do you know that?
Oh, Miss Cortland, please, you're wasting priceless time.
All right, I'll call. But I'll ask you a lot of questions afterwards. I want to talk to Wichita, Kansas Airport. I haven't the number.
You make a practice of predicting plane crashes?
Oh, no.
I'll wait, thank you.
Maybe just the planes of very rich men.
Oh, please.
Perhaps you're betting that he doesn't beat the record.
Hello. Hello, this is Whitney Cortland's daughter. When my father lands, have him call me immediately, will you? What? Oh, no. Oh, no!
The radio had it a few minutes later. In an hour, the extras were on the street. The Comanche Angel had crashed in Kansas. Both men were dead.
Yeah, that's the first portion of Night Has a Thousand Eyes, about a guy who can see into the future, Lisa. Edward G. Robinson. If I could see into the future, you know what I would... I'd look at the lotto numbers.
Well, sometimes I think you have special powers, but I've told you that before.
I definitely have some special powers.
You have some magic.
Magic. Ooh.
You do.
All right. We'll get back to the Screen Directors Playhouse in a few minutes. First, these words. All right. This is the WGN Radio Theater. Lisa and I and Elif are here every single Saturday and Sunday night from 11 p.m. till 2 o'clock in the morning. 6 hours of classic radio. We usually play 6 half-hour shows in that 6 hours. So we are tuning in to Night Has a Thousand Eyes, starring Edward G. Robinson from 1949. Here's the conclusion now of the Screen Directors Playhouse.
You've been very kind helping me over these past few days, Mr. Triton. I'm so grateful.
Your father was my best friend.
But... if you'd only warned us sooner, if you'd only known sooner.
I don't think it would have made any difference.
Mr. Triton, what's wrong?
You have a new maid.
Why, yes, why?
You have an emerald bracelet.
Yes.
Get rid of the maid before the bracelet. Before...
What? Please, tell me.
Jean... it doesn't matter now.
Why doesn't it matter? You mean, not to me? You mean, I won't need the bracelet? You mean, I'm going to die too? Tell me!
Yes.
When?
Soon?
When?
before the end of the week. At night. Under the stars. Jean.
NBC Theater is presenting the Screen Directors Guild production of Night Has a Thousand Eyes, starring Edward G. Robinson with William Demarest and introducing the director of the film, John Farrow.
You remember, Carson. You went to the police. They told you, yes, there had been a John Triton, mental wizard, who pretended to be able to predict things back in the 20s. They sent a certain detective, Lieutenant Sean, to investigate me where I was staying in Jean's house. My first interview with Sean in my little room under the eaves, far from reassure the good lieutenant, for even as I answered his bitter questions, the veil lifted again. And I saw.
Hey, Triton, come out of it. Hey.
I see a flower.
Ah, drop it, Triton. Cut.
A flower, crushed and broken. I hear a sudden wind shaking the windows. I hear a voice saying, there's no danger now. And I see her.
Who?
Jean, lying under the stars. And beside her, the paws and talons of a lion? Under the stars.
Did you find out what time this happens to Miss Cortland?
Tonight, as the clock strikes 11. Lieutenant Sean was all for arresting me at once. The rest of you were tolerantly skeptical, which saved me for a while. Downstairs with Jean and you, Carson, were two gentlemen, a Mr. Gilman.
Mr. Gilman, president of Mid-Tide Oil.
Good evening, Mr. Triton.
And a Mr. Myers, attorney for Cortland's estate.
How do you do, Mr. Triton?
Together, we sat down for the next 2 hours. Our lives were geared to the relentless machinery of the grandfather's clock that ticked away near the curtained archway.
Frankly, I think this is ridiculous. Singing around like this when we should be looking for a packet of missing options?
I'm sure I'll find them, Mr. Myers.
They'll be worthless in 36 hours.
Gina, are you sure you can't remember where your father put those options?
Please, Mr. Gilman, I'm much too upset.
Well, the mid-tide merger can't go through without them.
I suggest Jean be permitted to forget about big business while we all concentrate
on the clock, Mr. Carson.
Shut up, Triton.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
One down.
And one more hour to go.
And so far nothing has materialized in your weird chain of events. A crushed flower indeed, a lion, a sudden wind.
Anyone interested in the 10 o'clock news? Here. Personally, I'm interested in the 11 o'clock
news. Which was upset in a collision tonight at Wilshire and Sepulveda. The lion escaped. When a trailer...
Turn that off.
Lion?
Lock the doors. Lock the windows. Put out some lights.
I'll lock up. I'll go through the whole house.
Thanks, Gilman.
Well, there's the lion. We haven't heard a wind, or seen a crushed flower, or heard anyone say...
Don't say it.
Sorry.
Hey, those carnations in that vase. Get them out.
Carnations?
Get them out. I don't believe any of this, but I'm taking no chance.
I'll give them, Lieutenant.
Careful now. Stand back. Don't anybody move. Ha. Not a one crushed.
That was a close one.
Mr. Myers. Huh? There's something sticking out under your foot.
Something, huh?
Lord.
A carnation. Crushed and broken.
That does it, Triton.
No, not quite. Nothing final can happen until 11 o'clock.
And it ain't going to happen because you're around. I'm taking you downtown until after 11.
All right, Lieutenant, but it won't do any good. I'll be back at 11.
Stand still, Triton. Relax.
Yes, but I tell you, Sean, if you let me return to Jean's house, there's a chance I can use this power of mine to save her.
You put on a good show, Triton. Only I ain't buying.
Now, listen. You've a man in the cell here. His name is Amos Block. I see him in his cell now, a suicide.
You don't say. Well, there's one I can check on. Hello, Quinn? Sean, how's Block doing? Uh-huh. Thanks. In his cell playing solitaire.
Well, nevertheless, I see him in it.
Now I'm going to leave you with the boys here and go back to Miss Cortland's. Be good, huh?
Fifteen minutes too, Jean.
Yes.
Yeah, everything is under control. It's very copacetic.
Ah! Oh, dear.
Close that French window. Close it.
I'll close it, Lieutenant.
I thought Gilman took care of that.
Where is Gilman, by the way?
There. That does it all right.
Sudden wind.
Yeah. I'll get it. Yeah? Oh, yeah, Quinn? No. Amos Block hung himself in his cell, but he can't do that. That's suicide. Hey, look, I want Triton here before it strikes 11. I don't care how, but get him here. What time is it?
10:47.
Oh, Lord, you made the night too long.
One more minute to go, darling.
45 seconds.
Oh, Mr. Myers.
Well, folks, you can forget the lion. They just killed it over at Veteran Hospital.
Oh, thank goodness.
This is it. 11 o'clock.
Elliot.
Yeah?
Back to back with me. Miss Cortland, get between us. Don't anybody move. I'll shoot the man who does. That's it, folks.
It's all over. Nothing's happened.
Oh, Elliot. Elliot, darling.
It's all history now, dear. Forget it.
Elliot.
Hmm?
I'm going outside.
I'll go with you.
No. I want to get used to standing out under the stars again. Alone. And not being afraid. Thank you, dear. Thank you so much. All of you.
I'll say this for Triton. He sure called his shots, except that voice saying, there's no danger now.
You just said it.
Yeah, but it's too late now to mean anything. Ain't it?
Sean.
Come in, Professor, come in.
Where is she? Where's Miss Cortland?
Outside.
You let her go outside?
It's after 11.
No, it's not.
Look at the clock.
That clock is wrong.
It was right.
Well, then it's been tampered with. I've got to go to her.
Stop, Triton. Haul her out, shoot.
It's too late for that, after him. He mustn't get near Jean.
Eight. Nine. Ten. 11.
That's right. 11 o'clock, Miss Cortland.
Oh, Oh, Mr. Gilman.
Your troubles are over now. No danger now.
11 o'clock. And a voice saying, there's no danger. He must have met you.
Oh, no, you don't.
No, please help me.
Gilman, let go of her. Let go of her, you fool.
Hey, Sean. Right. Get him.
Clubbed him, but good.
Gene, are you all right?
Oh, Ellie.
It's all right, Gene. You're safe now. Triton's dead.
Triton? Dead? But it was Gilman who tried to kill me.
Gilman, he didn't want those options found. But I didn't think he'd resort to murder.
Oh, poor Mr. Gilman. He died to save me.
But are you all right?
My throat hurts. Elliot, look. Mr. Triton. He's resting against the foot of that marble lion.
Marble lion. Of course.
And that, Carson, ends this dark diary. I foresaw everything, even my own death. And tonight at headquarters, I finished this diary. I left it in my pocket for you to find. Only time and the expanding wisdom of mankind will confirm the story in years to come. For there are reaches of the mind still undreamed of, and there are many mysteries of time and space and spirit to be shown to us. The stars look down. The night has 1,000 eyes to search the soul of man and see if he's equal to his fathomless tomorrows. Where there are yet more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of in our philosophy.
And now, here again are tonight's stars, Edward G. Robinson and William Demarest, and screen director, John Farrell.
John, it's been great fun for Bill and me, slipping back into character for our parts, Night Has 1,000 Eyes.
Well, I just hope Bill here doesn't start having one of his visions again. I see us being cut off the air if we don't say goodnight. Good night, everyone.
Good night, folks.
And good night to you, Edward G. Robinson, William Demarest, and John Farrell. Night Has 1,000 Eyes was adapted by Milton Geiger from an original story by Cornell Walrick. Music was by Henry Russell. Production was supervised by Howard Wiley. Associate producer Bill Carr. Your announcer has been Frank Barton. Night Has 1,000 Eyes was presented through the courtesy of Paramount Pictures, currently releasing My One True Love, starring Phyllis Calvert, Melvin Douglas, and Wanda Hendricks. Edward G. Robinson is currently making the 20th Century Fox production, The House of Strangers. William Demarest may be seen in Paramount's Technicolor production, Whispering Smith. Listen again next week for the NBC Theater's full-hour presentation of...
Screen Directors Guild Assignment, production of Foreign Affair, director Billy Wilder, stars Rosalind Russell, Marlena Dietrich, John Lund.
The Screen Directors Guild program came to you from Hollywood. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
The familiar NBC chimes there at the end of the Screen Directors Playhouse presentation of Night Has 1,000 Eyes, starring Edward G. Robinson. And you heard the director of the film, Bill Karn, there making a curtain call, talking about the making of the movie. And Paul Frees, one of the, he was Boris Badenov on the Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, is in that cast, Paul Frees. And you heard William Demarest from My Three Sons. Remember that series?
I sure do.
He was Uncle Somebody da, or da, Other. Da, 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 da. He was Uncle Charlie, I think his name was on that. I could be wrong, because I didn't really like that show.
You didn't like that show with
Not
Fred McMurray?
Really, no, I really didn't like that show.
I like that show.
I think
show.
He was Uncle Charlie on that. All right, let's take a break. Then it's more here on the WGN Radio Theater. All right. We had a lot of commercials. We've had a lot of commercials this morning on
this
the WGN Radio Theater.
And last night.
Nick, do they just give you like all these commercials? You got to try to get them all in with everything you're going on. There's a lot of commercials.
Well, that's good.
I guess that's good.
Depends on the perspective we're talking
about. That's the point.
I guess that sounded like I was complaining. I wasn't complaining. What I mean is it's like there's a lot of things to get in an hour. Plus, we're playing a half-hour classic radio show in an hour there.
Right.
And then Elif is talking all the time.
Yeah,
and
she
Lisa,
makes us crazy.
You know, talking all the time.
Lisa and Elif. It's just us.
It's Lisa and Elif.
Please.
I can't get all the commercials in with Lisa and Elif. So, Nick, good to see you, man. How are you?
I'm all right.
We're into the classic radio Halloween programming.
I love that stuff, man.
Yeah, we got a lot of it.
It's my favorite time of year.
Me too.
October is my favorite
month. Me too. And it's going to be a great October because we have the Cubs in the playoffs.
That's right.
And they start Friday. Do we know who they play?
It depends on who wins the Giants.
The Mets
game.
And the Giants,
yeah. They get the one-off game. So.
I kind of hope it's the Giants.
You know what? I kind of hope it's the Mets just to get them back
To get them back, yeah.
For last year, yeah.
Gosh, they beat us up pretty good last
year. 4 games.
Oh, man.
They got swept.
I'm a little worried about that.
Don't worry.
Of course, who's pitching? Is Arrieta pitching, or is it going to be?
It's probably going to be, I would imagine.
Lester?
Hendricks, I would imagine.
Oh, okay, Hendricks.
He's ridiculous
now.
Actually, you know, Lester just pitched the other day. Maybe it's going to be Lester will be in the number one slot.
I kind of think it might be. Yeah.
Arrieta has slipped down to two, I think. But, the way that Hendricks is pitching, it's ridiculous.
I know. It's unbelievable, right? He's lights out.
Unbelievable.
So what's on the show?
Movie reviews. We'll talk about the movie reviews. We're also going to talk about some of the best cheap sandwiches that you can get in the city. There are also some very unusual holidays that you can celebrate in October. And we'll talk about that.
Mm.
And my dad will call in and tell a joke, too.
That sounds great. You know, there's a movie I'm going to see this week, The Magnificent Seven.
Yeah.
So are you going to talk about that, or have you talked about it?
Well, we did last week. We reviewed it
last week. Yeah, okay, because I heard that you were going to talk about it, but I missed it.
I liked it.
You liked it a lot?
Yeah, I did.
I'm going to see it this week.
Yeah, I did. I liked it.
So stick around, because Nick DiGilio is up next. You don't want to miss that.